Hello and thank you for joining us for Into the Killing. If you have a case you want us to cover on Into the Killing or one of our YouTube channels, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Then you just go to the Suggest a Case page. For this episode of Into the Killing, we're going back to December 1969. On December 1st, 1969, the first draft lottery was held in the United States since World War II. The United States government was looking for more soldiers for their controversial war in Vietnam. The first day drawn was September 14th, so any man who was born on that date between 1944 and 1951 was summoned to enlist. The draft was very unpopular and it strengthened the anti-war movement, but the war continued for another 5.5 years. On December 6, 1969, the Altamont Speedway Free Festival was held outside of Tracy, California. The concert was to feature Santana, Jefferson Airplane, The Flying Burrito Brothers, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Grateful Dead, and The Rolling Stones. 300,000 people attended the concert. The motorcycle club, the Hells Angels, were hired to be security for the event. They were paid $500 worth of beer. They drank the beer in front of the stage for most of the day. Throughout the day, crowd members became unruly, and there were fights among the concertgoers. Audience members also fought with members of the Hells Angels, who were becoming extremely intoxicated. Things got so violent that the Grateful Dead chose not to play. The Rolling Stones took the stage last. As they played their song, Under My Thumb, 18-year-old Meredith Hunter tried to get on stage. He was pushed away by members of the Hells Angels. Hunter got angry and he tried to get back on the stage. A Hells Angel, Alan Passacero, saw Hunter pull out a gun. Passacero was armed with a knife. He ended up stabbing 18-year-old Meredith Hunter to death. The stabbing was recorded by a documentary team who was recording the end of the Rolling Stones tour. The Rolling Stones supposedly did not know about the stabbing and they finished their set. Unfortunately, this was not the only death at the concert. Around midnight, a 1964 Plymouth plowed into a group of people sitting around a campfire. Mark Figer and Richard Savloff, both 22, were killed and two other people were seriously injured. The driver was never identified. A fourth man died when he drowned in an irrigation canal while trying to sneak into the concert. Besides the four deaths, many other people were injured. Many people were injured by the Hells Angels, who were heavy-handed as security guards. Alan Passacero was charged with the murder of Meredith Hunter, but he was ultimately acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. The chaos of the Altamont Free Concert was encapsulated in the now-classic documentary, Gimme Shelter. Many people believe that the concert was a symbolic end to the free love era of the 1960s. Others say it was simply a poorly planned concert that happened in the last month of the 1960s, and people attach way too much symbolism to it. On December 14, 1969, the number one movie was the Western musical, Paint Your Wagon. The film starred Lee Marvin, Clint Eastwood, and Gene Seberg. The number one song was the classic folk song, Leaving on a Jet Plane, by Peter, Paul, and Mary. In December 1969, 25-year-old Diane Maxwell Jackson lived in Houston, Texas. Diane was born on May 12, 1944, in Louisiana. At some point, her family moved to the Houston area. Her father owned a construction company. Diane graduated from high school in 1962. In 1965, she got married and had a son. But the marriage didn't last, and by 1969, Diane was divorced and raising her 4-year-old son. She worked as a telephone operator in downtown Houston. On the afternoon of Sunday, December 14, 1969, Diane drove a red Ford Mustang to work. Since it was Sunday, the downtown core was mostly empty. Tragically, Diane never made it inside her workplace. About 30 minutes after Diane's shift started her shift, a 35-year-old unhomed man named Willie Bell Jr. noticed something unusual. He saw a man walking away from a shack behind an abandoned service station that was next to the parking lot. He decided to check the shack. 25-year-old Diane Maxwell Jackson was inside of it. She was nude except for her bra. Her hands were bound behind her back. Bell went and called the police. By the time they arrived on scene, Diane had died. Inside the shack, the police found a pink blanket and a man's suit jacket. But they weren't sure if either item belonged to the killer or if they were in the shack before the murder. Diane's purse was found in the shack. Her purse didn't have any money in it, and her car keys were gone. The police believe that Diane drove to work, but she was kidnapped before she could enter the building. The police interviewed Willie Bell Jr. The only description he could give of the man he saw leaving the shack was that he was black with an afro. 9 hours after the murder, the police found Diane's car. It was abandoned about a mile from the crime scene. It was locked and the keys were in the ignition. The police checked the car and they found 3 fingerprints and a partial palm print. An autopsy was performed on Diane. It was determined that she had been raped. She had been stabbed once in the abdomen with what the medical examiner called surgical precision. The single stab wound had cut a main artery. The stab was so precise that the medical examiner thought that the killer had some medical training. The police's first suspect was Willie Bell Jr. However, his fingerprints didn't match those found in the car. The problem was that in 1969, there was no computerized system for fingerprints, so fingerprints had to be manually compared one by one. Since the police didn't have a suspect, they started comparing the fingerprints to black men who were arrested recently. Then they started fingerprinting black men who hung out downtown, which, unfortunately, was not considered controversial at the time. They also focused on black men who worked in healthcare. Yet, they didn't find a match to the prints. The murder haunted Diane's father. He desperately wanted the case solved. But then months and then years went by and no persons of interest emerged. 17 long years passed. Then in 1986, Diane's brother, David, became a member of the Texas Rangers. One of the reasons he got into law enforcement was so that he could hopefully solve Diane's murder. Around the same time, the Houston Police Department purchased an AFIS system. AFIS stands for Automated Fingerprint Identification System. It's a computerized system that quickly compares unknown prints to the prints of people who had been arrested. Dave requested that the fingerprints of his sister's killer be compared to those who had been arrested. He thought that his sister's killer must have committed another crime. He didn't think he could just rape and murder a woman and then go on to live life as a law-abiding citizen. But no match to the prints was found. Without any other clues to follow up on, the case went cold again. Another 17 years passed, bringing us to 2003. It had been 34 years since Diane Maxwell was murdered. Had she been alive, she would have been 59. Her only son was 38. Her father was now 88, and he was desperate to see the case closed before he died. His son and Diane's brother, David, was still a Texas Ranger, and he wanted to have the case closed to grant his father's wish and for his own peace of mind. David and Diane's father said he constantly dreamed about Diane, and he thought about her all the time. In 1969, the biggest television shows were Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, followed by 2 westerns, Gunsmoke and Bonanza. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Love Bug, and Midnight Cowboy were the 3 biggest movies that year. In 1969, the number one song was by a fictional animated band. It was Sugar Sugar by the Archies. Number 2 was Aquarius / Let the Sunshine In by the Fifth Dimension. And the number 3 was I Can't Get Next to You by the Temptations. Some new products introduced in 1969 were Gain Detergent, Adidas Superstar Sneakers, and Glue Sticks. Some tasty food that was sold for the first time were Wendy's Frosties, Orville Redenbacher's Popcorn, and Frosted Mini Wheats. 34 years later, in 2003, the 3 biggest TV shows were CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, and then 2 episodes of American Idol. The performance show got slightly more viewers than the results show that followed the next night. As for movies, the 3rd and final Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, was the biggest movie. Finding Nemo was 2nd, and The Matrix Reloaded, the 2nd Matrix movie, was the 3rd biggest. The 3 biggest songs were In a Club by 50 Cent, Ignition by R. Kelly, and Get Busy by Sean Paul. As for new products in 2003, you could buy a Nintendo Game Boy Advance SP, a the Motorola Razr in Cialis. When it came to food, you could get McGriddles from McDonald's, Lora bars were sold in stores, and Starbucks introduced one of their most famous products of all time, the pumpkin spice latte. David Maxwell decided to ask his friend Jim Ramsey for help investigating his sister's murder. Ramsey was a veteran homicide detective with the Houston Police Department. They had been friends for years, but Ramsey had no idea that David's sister had been murdered. David said he didn't want people to give him sympathy, so he kept that part of his life private. As we just went over, much had changed in the 34 years since Diane had been murdered. One major change was that DNA had become an incredibly powerful crime-fighting tool. Ramsey thought if they could have Diane's clothes tested for DNA, it might help them solve the crime. Unfortunately, the clothing had been destroyed. David and Ramsey also learned that the crime scene photos and the negatives were missing. But they thought they caught a lucky break because someone had violated the rules. Someone with access to the photos had sold them to a British crime magazine, Master Detective, in 1971. Ramsey contacted the publisher. Unfortunately, they didn't have the photos or the negatives. The only thing they had was a single copy of the edition. Because it was their only copy, they didn't want to send it to Ramsey and David. Ramsey convinced them to photocopy the article and send it to them. However, when they received the photocopy of the article, they realized that the photos were useless to their investigation. Undeterred, David and Ramsey tried to track down the only witness to the crime, Willie Bell Jr. They learned he had moved out to California, but he had been dead for nearly 20 years. At the very least, they had the fingerprints. David knew they existed because they were compared to other fingerprints in 1986. But David was shocked to learn that the fingerprints were not in the case file. In 1986, the fingerprints that were saved in APHIS were of known people who had been arrested in Houston. It didn't store the fingerprints of unknown offenders. But it didn't appear that the fingerprints were destroyed. Instead, they were probably filed incorrectly and they were in another open case file. Unfortunately, if that was the case, then there was a good chance that they would never be found. It would not be like looking for a needle in a haystack. Instead, you'd be looking for a very specific piece of straw in a haystack. Without the fingerprints, there was no evidence left to investigate. But, since it was the only piece of evidence they knew existed, every day someone in the Latent Fingerprints Department looked for the prints in the open case files. This included open files on every type of crime, like assault, burglaries, car thefts, and etc. They spent months looking for the prints. But then, David Maxwell and Jim Ramsey's luck began to change. Someone finally found the prints. But there was still a problem. If the killer had not been arrested again, they would not have his fingerprints on file. And the case might go cold again and remain that way forever. First, the fingerprints were compared to fingerprints in the Texas State Database, but no match was found. The fingerprints were then run through the FBI's National Database. The database just went online 3 years earlier. They found 20 potential matches. Those 20 sets of fingerprints were mainly compared to the fingerprints found in Diane's car. One set of prints was an exact match. They were the fingerprints of a 58-year-old man named James Ray Davis. He had a long criminal record and he had spent half his life in prison. He had convictions for burglary, possession of stolen property, and vehicle theft. In the early 1990s, he was released from prison after being convicted of kidnapping a young girl. In December 1969, Davis had been out of prison for 5 days before Diane was killed. He was arrested about a month later for auto theft outside of Texas, which is why his fingerprints were not in the Houston Police Department system or the State of Texas database. Since being released in the early 1990s, he had been living in a federally funded housing complex in Texarkana on the Texas and Arkansas border. He had been a model citizen since his release. In August 2003, Jim Ramsey went to Davis's apartment to question him. One of the problems with the fingerprints was that they were only found in the car. They weren't found in the shack where the murder was committed. As we mentioned, there was no other evidence. So, if Davis had another explanation for why his fingerprints were in the car, like he found the car abandoned and went joyriding, their investigation may come to a full stop and the case would never be solved. When Ramsey showed Davis a photograph of Diane Maxwell's car, he averted his eyes. He claimed he had never seen the car before. Ramsey thought that this was an odd statement because it was a red Ford Mustang. He doubted that Davis had never seen one in his entire life. He then took out a photo of Diane and tried to hand it to Davis. He refused to take it. Ramsey then told him they had matched his fingerprints to those in the car. Davis then confessed to Diane's murder. He said he had been hanging outside the parking lot of Diane's work. When he started pulling to the parking lot, he planned to rob her. He walked up to her and pressed his knife into her abdomen. He then led her to the shack. He said that he robbed her, but he denied raping her. He then stabbed her. He got into her car and drove off. After the confession, James Davis was arrested. In November 2003, 34 years after the murder of Diane Maxwell, James Davis pleaded guilty to her murder. In January 2004, he was sentenced to life in prison. Both Jim Ramsey and David Maxwell believe that a little something extra was at work that helped them solve the case. Ramsey told Forensic Files that the odds of them closing the case were 1 billion to 1, so he believes that there was divine intervention at play. He also believes that David's unselfish life may have led God to say, "I'll give him a break with this case." No matter what you believe, Ramsey and David did overcome amazing odds to close the case. Diane's father lived long enough to see Davis arrested and convicted. He was apparently ecstatic when he learned of Davis's arrest. He died in 2010 at the age of 95. The life sentence for James Ray Davis was not too long. When he was arrested, he was in bad health. He lived for another 3.5 years after he was convicted. He died in prison in June 2007 at the age of 62. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Like we said in the opening, if you have a case you want us to cover on Into the Killing or one of our YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening.